Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, January the 19th. And welcome to our commentary. We're going to talk a little bit about Davos, you know, that meeting that they have, I guess, every year or every 2 years, whatever it is, that ends up being a lot of hot air. And I've got a few thoughts about that. But before I do, I want to direct you to my latest post over at the American Thinker. I wrote a post that I wanted to write for quite some time, and I finally put it together and got it posted over there. And it has to do with a man by the name of Fulgencio Batista. Now, if you're not from Cuba, I was born in Cuba, so that name rings a bell. But if you're not from Cuba, you may not recognize that name. Batista was the dictator in Cuba before Castro, and he was the one who was overthrown or left the country, and then the communist regime came in. And of course, for years, he's been one of those historical figures who create the reaction. I mean, when you mention the name Batista to anybody from Cuba, let's say, especially my parents' generation who were there during all of that, you get a reaction. You get an extreme reaction. You know, some people like him, some people hate him. And it's very difficult to have any kind of objectivity in looking back at his record. So what I wanted to do was at some point to sit there and say, well, let's compare what Cuba was like under Batista to what Cuba is like under Castro. And now we have almost half a century of comparative information and data. And that's what I was trying to do with my post, to take a look at Cuba after, you know, look at the Batista period and see where Cuba was, and look at the communist period and see where Cuba is right now. And it's, you know, I look at it and trying to be as objective as I can. And it's difficult for me to see how anybody can say that Castro or the Cuban people or the Cuban country or the Cuban nation is better off under the almost six decades now of communist regime compared to the way it was before Batista. I mean, when Batista was a dictator, nobody's denying that. And in my post, I make it very clear that, you know, I'm not defending the mistakes and the things that were done poorly. But you got, if you look at the record, no, there's no doubt that the people of Cuba were living a lot better overall in 1959 than they are now. And the biggest difference, I think, is that during the years that Batista was there, you didn't see a raft full of people showing up in Florida. You didn't have thousands of Cubans who died drowning in the Straits of Florida coming to the United States. So I think the time has come to take a look at Batista and take a look at his record and at least have some kind of a conclusion. And my conclusion is that Cuba was much better off under his leadership, with all of his mistakes, with all of the corruption and everything else, that Cuba was better off under his leadership than it has been under communists. So check out my post. I have a lot of data in there that you may want to take a look at, but check it out. And I think you will see or agree with me that Cuba was better off before than it has been under communist rule. Well, let's talk a little bit about Davos. I don't know how often this conference happens, once a year, every 2 years, I don't know, but it seems like they have these conferences and they all, you know, you get a bunch of people talking, you know, you get a bunch of people speaking like Al Gore and John Kerry, and it ends up being a lot of hot air because they're saying a bunch of things that are never going to happen. One of the problems with climate change that it sounds really good in the abstract when you give a speech. But when you have to turn it into some kind of legislation, it always runs into the reality that you're going to have to explain to the middle class why their electricity rates have to go up, why their gasoline prices have to go up, and why they have to see their jobs go to China in order to meet some arbitrary climate change goals or whatever. And the voters simply say, no, not so fast, not so fast. So climate change has always been something, again, that works real good in the abstract. And you hear all these speeches at Davos. Well, when you try to make it happen, it usually doesn't happen. Another problem, and there's an article in the New York Times that I saw, where I think a lot of climate change activists are starting to realize that their tactics are actually hurting their strategy, that they need to change the way they're telling us that climate change is going to overwhelm the world. And we've seen here lately some of the most outrageous examples of this, where, you know, where they're destroying property at a museum, or where they're interfering with traffic. And, you know, if you want to persuade people, if you want people to listen to your case, I don't think shutting down traffic is a good idea. I don't think walking into a museum and destroying a work of art is a good idea. And I think a lot of these climate change people are beginning to realize that they're nothing, or they come across as a bunch of alarmists rather than people who have something good to say. And last but not least, and this is the one thing missing from the Davos presentation, and it's always missing from the Davos presentation, it's always missing from all of these climate change protests, is when are we going to talk about China? When are we going to go and march in front of the Chinese embassy and tell them to stop polluting the air? Tell them to do something, because the Chinese never want to do anything, because they just want to keep pumping all that stuff into the air and stealing everybody's manufacturing in the name of climate change. So the Davos presentation this year, as it always ends up being, is just a little get together for a bunch of people in their private jets who fly to Switzerland, have a great time. They eat great food. They have a great time. They tell each other how smart they are, but nothing happens. And nothing happens because what they are saying is very difficult to explain. As I say to a middle-class family, the ones who are going to have to pay more for electricity, the ones who are going to have to pay more for gasoline, the ones who are going to see their manufacturing companies move to China, and they're sitting saying, wait a minute, what's in it for me? How are you helping me by having me pay higher electricity rates and higher gasoline rates, or seeing my the manufacturing move to China? How is that helping me? It's not. And that's why this Davos thing is nothing but an ego trip. That's all that it is, just a massive ego trip on the part of many of these people who just go there and shout a lot of hot air, like we heard from our former Vice President Al Gore, who wrote a book a few years ago predicting all these things that have never happened. You know, all these things that he said were going to happen have never happened. You know, about cities being flooded because of all this water coming down because the glaciers are melting. None of that has ever happened. But yet they still give him a standing ovation when he goes to these places. It's just absolutely amazing. A couple of quick things that I wanted to go through today. Everybody in the media is asking questions of the press secretary, and some of these White House briefings have gotten a little tense. I am not a defender of the press secretary. I think she is exhibit A of identity politics. In other words, people who are selected because of their skin color, because of their gender, because of their sexual orientation, instead of being picked because they know what they're talking about or they have some talent in whatever they're doing. Well, the press secretary is having a difficult time with the media because the media wants to know, and she's not telling them anything. Now, I'm going to cut the press secretary a little slack on this. I don't think it's her job to tell people what's going on with these documents. That's the president's job. And obviously, he never does press conferences. He should be the one holding a press conference, not the press secretary. Also, I am not sure, again, just not defending her, but cutting her a little bit of slack. I don't think she knows everything that's going on. In other words, I don't think she's part of the inner circle. I don't think they call her when they're making these decisions. I think they call her after the meeting and say, look, these are your talking points. This is what you're going to tell the press today. And if they ask you any questions, you just refer them to whatever. So I don't think she knows, honestly. I think she's being kept in the dark on purpose, because I think this is a little group of people who know that they're in trouble and they're trying to manage the crisis as best as they can. So not defending the press secretary. I'm just simply saying that I think you're shooting at the wrong target if you're angry with her. You need to be angry with the president, and the media needs to start demanding that the president does a press conference, something that he doesn't do. I mean, he doesn't do press conferences. I don't remember the last time that we had a president who doesn't do press conferences. I don't remember the last time we had somebody run for the presidency without a press conference. That's another thing. Do you remember in the 2020 campaign? He didn't do press conferences either. I don't know. Something is wrong. So get on the president, not the press secretary. He works for her, and he's only doing whatever she's being told to do. I don't know how many of you have seen this statue of Martin Luther King. I think it's in Boston. I have not personally seen it, but I've seen the photos. That is the strangest statue that I have ever seen, especially honoring a man like Dr. Martin Luther King. I mean, you would think that if you're going to honor a man like Dr. King, maybe you put up a statue of Dr. King or a bust of Dr. King, but that statue is the ugliest thing that I've ever seen. And I don't even know what it is. I mean, what is the image of this thing? I mean, what you see is hands. And again, I don't know. I think it's ugly. So that's all I can tell you. But you got to be careful how you criticize these things, because, you know, they call you a racist if you say anything critical. But I don't think that statue makes Dr. Martin Luther King look good. And I thought the objective of statues was to remember people and to bring out their greatness. That statue doesn't do that one bit. Well, I want to say happy number 77 today to Dolly Parton. If you like country music, you know who I'm talking about. I think she goes beyond country music, but I think she's made a movie or two and recorded quite a few songs. But, you know, she had 25 number one songs. I didn't know that. She had 25 number one songs, country songs, that is. So this is a lady with a lot of appeal. Let's just say that. We also remember a couple of performers of our generation. We remember Janis Joplin, who was born on this day, 1970. She was born in Texas, and of course, she passed away very young in 1970. And we remember Phil Everly of the Everly Brothers, the greatest of all the duos, the Everly Brothers, who not only had a string of hits as the Everly Brothers, but also had tremendous influence in the vocal styles of the Beatles and many of the groups that came in the 60s, who grew up listening to the Everly Brothers and their vocal styles. That two-part harmony that the Everly Brothers made famous was very influential on the Beatles, on John Lennon and Paul McCartney, how they sang together, very influential. Phil Everly, he and his brother Don Everly, were the great Everly Brothers. Thank you for listening. Have a great day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.